Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Facebook, iPhones, constant connectivity are a fact of modern life. But does technology and the omnipresent media really enrich our relationships, boost our moods, enhance our intellectual capacity, or is the opposite true? Are machines making us stupid? That's the title of a class taught at Weber State University by my guest, Susan Matt. She's a professor and chair of the History Department at Weber State University. And Susan Matt, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Luke Fernandez, Manager of Program and Technology Development at Weber. And Luke, thanks to you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me too.
They teach the course along with the English professor, Scott Rogers, Are Machines Making Us Stupid? And they joined me in studio. Do you think the internet is changing the way you read, write, or even think? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Your syllabus says you are looking at how technology affects our inner lives and how everyday people cope with it. What got you interested in this topic, first of all? Luke
sure.
Fernandez.
Yeah, I'm a developer of software technology at Weber State, and I subscribed to a CIO listserv. And on the CIO listserv, there was a CIO asking, how can we increase connectivity on campus, which is an initiative that lots of campuses are engaged in. And what I was asking on that CIO listserv was, well, are there times when we also want to disconnect? Because there's a lot of faculty who in their classrooms see the intrusion of technologies as intrusive, as interruptive. Do we need classrooms that have sort of ways of disconnecting from the internet? And one of the CIOs suggested, well, put in a Faraday cage, which is, not everyone knows what a Faraday cage is, but it's a lead-lined room in which electromagnetic waves are prevented from entering, so that you can keep people on your class on task and sort of focused without having the distractions of the internet at hand. Unfortunately, that sort of technological solution is pretty impractical. It costs a lot of money to build those sorts of rooms. So based on that sort of problem, I proposed to the National Endowment of the Humanities that we develop some software that could perhaps do something comparable. And so what we're doing is we're repurposing some testing centers on campus and having our students go in there and write their assignments in those particular contexts, and we can moderate the level of connectivity that they have vis-a-vis the web. So on this upcoming assignment, they have some limited connectivity to the web, but fairly limited. And on the next assignment, we'll probably vary that. And based on these sort of different contexts, writing contexts in which sometimes they have complete access and sometimes limited contexts, we want the students to explore the extent to which these different contexts help improve their ability to write or degrade it.
I'm sure you read this piece a number of years ago in The Atlantic by the tech writer Nicholas Carr. It's titled, Is Google Making Us Stupid? And he complained that the internet seems to be chipping away at my capacity for concentration and contemplation. Is that what got you involved in this project, Susan Matt? I mean, do you feel that sort of the distraction is impeding your scholarship?
Absolutely. It used to be much easier to go into a library with a pad of paper and not even know what was going on in the news. And when I switched to a laptop for a while, that worked. But then I got wireless, and email announcements alert me that I've got incoming mail, and I could check my Facebook. And it's a lot harder to close off the rest of the world, but I think that's necessary. And in our class, there are a range of opinions between the three of us, and I think I'm probably the most pessimistic about what technology is doing to us. I really feel like it's intruding on concentration, eating away at our ability to focus, and making it a lot harder to get good work done.
Well, we'll get to some of those opinions and conclusions in a minute, but as a historian, I mean, is this a new problem, or have we as humans worried about the effect of technology on our lives, on our relationships before? Is this a familiar tune?
It is a familiar tune. People worried about the telephone, that the telephone would bring in intrusions and strangers into the household and
they
ruin
kind of
your
did.
Quiet time. It's true. And the same about television. We are assigning articles about people's reactions to radio, and there were all these debates in the 1930s. Should you allow radio on campus? Maybe that was going to distract people. So I think there are recurrent worries. Just because they existed in the past doesn't mean we don't need to worry today, though, as well. I think each generation has to figure out how to adopt its technology most wisely.
Well, I guess that is part of the question, though. How is today different? If the radio was going to bring ruin to our world as we knew it, it didn't. At least I hope not, because we're here today talking on the radio. But if these are old questions and recurrent themes, how is today different? Luke Fernandez.
Well, you know, it's funny. You're asking the person who's not trained as the professional historian to answer this. So I'm learning a lot in this course. And one of the words that is new to me, but I think helps to sort of shed light on this, is the concept of chronocentrism, which is similar. You know, we're familiar with words like ethnocentrism ethnocentrism, you know, which is sort of centered on one's own culture. Well, similarly, chronocentrism is centered or the feeling that our own present day is somehow unique. That it's different from other eras, and that somehow technology and change is accelerating and happening more quickly now than it ever was. But the irony, or the paradox, I think, as Susan would tell you as the historian, is that the people in the 19th century were feeling very similarly. That is a good question. If every era feels the same way, are we really different? I think and so in some ways we're not. If you sort of are. Take exception to the idea of chronocentrism. But on the other hand, you know, I think there are, arguably we are, technology is changing and the world is changing much more rapidly now, and that there is a certain urgency now that there wasn't in the past. But that doesn't mean to say that past eras didn't also feel that there was urgency in their own times.
Do you, Susan, Matt, do you see our current predicament as somehow uniquely different from what we've experienced time and again through history?
Well, I think it's different in the details, in the speed of connectivity. I think it's similar in some other ways, however. In fact, today in class, after we leave here, we're going to be talking about the telegraph. And in the 19th century, people said the telegraph was going to be the nerve of international life. And they were just amazed that you could have the news 2 hours later from London. And they were blown away by the speed of life and how it had picked up. So it is all relative. I think our differences may be differences of degree rather than differences of kind between the generations.
We're speaking with Susan Matt, a professor and chair of the history department at Weber State University. Also with us, Luke Fernandez, manager of program and technology development at Weber. And they teach a course along with the English professor, Scott Rogers, titled, Are Machines Making Us Stupid? If you'd like to chime in on the conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. You're coming from the humanities. I don't see a hard scientist among you, but I'm wondering if there's any evidence other than the anecdotal, just this feeling that we're constantly getting interrupted and distracted. Is there any research that shows that technology is in some way rewiring our brains or the way that we approach work or the way that we're able to think very deeply about a subject? Luke?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and Nicholas Carr, you know, you referred to him earlier, the article he had in Atlantic earlier. There is a certain extent to which our brains have a certain degree of plasticity built in, so that our technologies, we're not just as human beings using tools, but they're in turn shaping the way we think about the world. So there's a certain degree of plasticity. But, this radio station is located right adjacent to the Leonardo Museum. And on the second floor of the Leonardo Museum, there's an exhibit, not just an exhibit, but a lab that people here in Salt Lake can go into and take a multitasking test. And it's being run by a faculty member in the psychology department up at Utah, at the University of Utah. And the findings there are that only about 2 or 3%, as my understanding, is that only 2 or 3% of the public are actually multitasking people, which presents an interesting conundrum because arguably a lot of our technologies, all of these technologies, while they have many virtues about being able to make us more connected, they also interrupt our abilities to proceed with one task without being interrupted by another. If we're not multitasking people, and if there's limits to what how plastic our brains is and how much we can adjust to our new tools, maybe there's a concern here.
Are students today worried about this? I mean, they grew up in a time when they were practically connected to the internet at birth, you know. I old schoolers like me, I mean, we didn't really embrace computers until high school. But I think people today, I mean, I see little kids in a restaurant, you know, toddlers playing around with an iPhone. I'm curious what your students think about this topic. Are they even worried about it? Luke Fernandez?
You know, I don't think it's a simple generational divide. I think we're seeing in our own class, we just did an informal survey at the beginning of the class, and there's 27 people in the class. And naturally, it's a self-selective bunch who probably are taking the course partly because they have a concerns about this. So what are some of the statistics we found there? I think we asked students, well, you know, if you had all the students sometimes have a pretty limited income. So we asked them, you know, if you had enough money to spare, would you buy yourself a mobile phone, an iPhone? And the majority of the class did. But then when we also asked them, you know, are your technologies making you too connected with the world? Would you like a space of remove in which you're separated when you have a chance to reflect and sort of engage in single task? They said they wanted that as well. So there sort of are, I guess to answer your question, there seem to be multivalent instincts at work among all generations with respect to that, mm-hmm. that question.
Susan Matt?
And even among our students, when we talk with them, some are adamant that this is just an issue of self-control, and if you can turn off the device, you should be fine and there are no problems. And others are much more worried about whether they have that self-control and whether there's something kind of addictive and seductive about the technology. So we see it even among people who are the same age, that some are pretty worried and some are pretty unconcerned.
But to do the kind of scholarship and research that can you do that? Can you multitask and think those deep thoughts? I mean, can you do the research while texting? You know what I'm saying? Susan Matt.
We just had our first assignment where the students were disconnected from Facebook, from email, and had to write in the concentration lab that Luke built. And while the papers are still kind of trickling in, the first student to answer the essay question, just sitting there with nothing else, said this was much easier and it went a lot more quickly than if I'd been doing it at home with my cell phone, with my Facebook on. We've had previous assignments where we have let students be as connected as they wanted to be, and one of them quite frankly said, in the course of writing this page, I've texted my girlfriend 5 times and she's texted me back 5 times. So they're aware of the problem, but they don't seem to be able to rein it in either.
But as professors, have you noticed a qualitative difference in the research? And we won't name any student names out there, but if you are being interrupted consistently by texting or, you know, this compelling need to check your email, is that hampering your ability or the level of deep thinking? Susan Matt.
There are some students who are just terrific and could measure up to any generation students. And then there are some where things do seem choppy. And the Frontline documentary, Digital Nation, talked about how this generation thinks in paragraphs because that's about all you can get out before, you know, a Facebook update happens. So I don't know if I've gathered data systematically enough to say, you know, 10 years ago it was a lot better, but I think others are clued into that.
I noticed that on your syllabus you reference a TED Talk by Clay Shirky, who writes the social and economic benefits of the internet. In this talk, he talks about the huge information overload, but we have there's a compelling need to filter out certain things. What are you hoping that students learn from that particular thought process, Luke?
Yeah, I think I don't know if I can give justice to Clay Shirky's TED Talk, which is, you know, 20 minutes long. But I think the basic thesis is that in the 20th century with media technologies, all of the filtering was done by the media companies, the large media companies. You know, you sat down and you watched TV and Ted Koppel or the announcers then decided what was the important news of the day and you listened to it. In the 21st century, though, we've in many ways democratized our technologies. There's many more sort of messages that you can listen to. And so there isn't big media companies filtering out the message for you. And so then it's incumbent upon each of us as individuals to do that filtering for ourselves. And I think that's part of what we're trying to get our students and ourselves to grasp is what are the most effective filters that we need to put in place since somebody isn't doing that for us now.
Your class is titled, Are Machines Making Us Stupid? Are you expecting to answer that question, or are you hoping that students will leave with more questions than answers? Susan, Matt?
I think it's the latter. We ourselves don't have a definitive answer, you know, and I probably would be one who would say, yeah, they are making us stupid. I think Luke would probably say, no, they're not. And Scott would be someplace in between. But, you know, we want our students to consider a whole range of questions. Are machines making us stupid? Are they making us antisocial or more social? Are they depoliticizing us or rousing us to more political action? Are they teaching us how to connect across nations, or are they just leaving us into our own insular world where we choose what we want to look at and ignore things that contradict it? So it's a whole range of questions, and we, as you say, won't have an answer, but our hope is that as students go forward, they'll have kind of the critical tools and analyses to go and question themselves as they're moving through the digital world.
Mm-hmm. Susan Matt, professor and chair of the history department at Weber State University. Susan, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Luke Fernandez, manager of program and technology development at Weber State University. Luke, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
They teach a course along with the English professor Scott Rogers titled Are Machines Making Us Stupid? They joined me in studio here in Salt Lake City. City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake. Thanks to Tamara Kemsley and Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. And you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Also follow us on Facebook and Twitter for those technical-minded among you. Next time, women and college. And why so many Utah students who are women don't graduate. We'll have that discussion tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.